I just want to just raise a couple of issues. They're largely policy issues, but they also do address quasi-engineering or project management issues that will affect this organisation if it advances to Ausrock, about Ausrock 7, I guess. But there are some aspects of the industry science and technology portfolio that you may find interesting, and then I'll just address specifically the objectives, functions and activities of my organisation and give a few thoughts on space policy, how it's likely to go, bearing in mind that this coming Monday the Prime Minister is currently scheduled to make a statement at the National Press Gallery in relation to the industry policy statement, which will be finalised at the Cabinet meeting next Monday. On top of that, on Tuesday we expect Cabinet to address a submission that I've put up to it in relation to getting approval to proceed with legislation for space activities, which will largely affect launching and of course also satellite operation. Most of this results from liabilities that the Commonwealth has accepted as a result of signing various United Nations treaties. So if you could put the other slide on, Mark, I'll just to generate a bit of thought and possible interest. As you can see, within the industry science and tourism portfolio, probably the totality of the space policy and space interested groups or who influence potential space are within the one organisation. Starting with the space policy unit, which I will give more details of later. We also, within that portfolio, we have Oz Industry, where the funding programs such as START and the IR&D board reside. The Science and Technology Division, which has various involvement with research councils, etc., within the Australian academic organisations. And of course, the CRC program is funded and managed in its broad sense from within that division. In fact, the person involved is Dr. John Boyd, who used to be one of the deputy executive directors of the Space Office. As a result of the Department of Administration, Admin Services being disbanded a few months ago after the travel rorts, Auslig has now moved into the same department, not just the portfolio, but in the department. And of course, from a remote sensing point of view, you've got the Australian Centre for Remote Sensing, which is part of that organisation, as is the Commonwealth Spatial Data Committee. So you both have an applications area there and a policy area for remote sensing. I've put down the Investment Promotion and Facilitation branch. That addresses major projects that are considered by government. And two of the current launch projects, one, the STS project and the IRC project, have both been accorded major project facilitation, and they provide a certain number of services to those types of projects. Customs, you may wonder why customs. Customs is within the same portfolio, and of course the two issues that cover customs is that, first of all, custom duties where they apply, and our attempts to have waivers on those for various classes of goods, and of course the way they class goods eventually determine whether or not wholesale sales tax is applicable to them. For example, at the moment launch vehicles and satellites have no duty on them, but because they are not exported, they are just imported, they attract wholesale sales tax. This is a 1901 thinking on the part of customs, and it's very difficult to change, but we're working towards that. And of course a 22% wholesale sales tax on payloads and and launch vehicles would virtually eliminate any possibility of there being a launch industry as such in this country, and for that matter, would even affect the payload aspect. So that's quite a savage situation which we have to really work to sort out. But they're working there. And just move to CSIRO. Well, Brian has mentioned the challenges within CSIRO as it affects certainly COSA and the Earth Observation Centre. And I've just included the Telecommunications and Industrial Physics Division there as one of the many divisions that are directly involved in space activities. Of course, that division is responsible for, amongst other things, for the NASA liaison and the Kidbinbilla and other NASA tracking stations in Australia. And we have quite a few dealings with them because as the Space Policy Unit, for example, is responsible for the treaty level agreements between nations for those types of activities. And actually I was somewhat surprised because I was not across the issues that Brian raised. And clearly with the change within CSIRO and the CRC and ourselves, there'll have to be quite a bit of dialogue in the new year so that we at least coordinate our activities. We don't have to be totally complementary, but at least we should make sure that we're not fighting each other without even knowing it. That's the only organisational slide I'm about to put up. But just to let you see that under the powers of the one minister, essentially all the national or activities of government that affect space are really within this one portfolio. Sure, there are other departments that utilise remote sensing, etc., like the Bureau of Meteorology, the geologist group, etc. But they're mostly users of a technology. But the areas that really influence space are within this portfolio, and it sort of makes you wonder, why we have all these problems, and hopefully we can address the issue from this point of view. Okay, thank you. I'll just now move on to the Space Policy Unit. As I indicated, the Space Policy Unit was formed virtually, the day after the budget of 96, which was the 20th of August. The Space Office sort of died, and this organisation was formed within the department, within Industry Division A, which is one of the three industry divisions in the department. At that stage, the view was that certainly COSRA at the time would be responsible for space science development as compared to the Space Policy Unit, which apart from the policy implications, would address industry development and commercial type space activities. And probably that the distinction between the two organisations was that we would look after the commercial activities and support industry in that way, but in terms of actual development of space projects, etc., that would have been a COSA function. Probably the biggest problem with all this was that no funding came with this change. At least the Space Office, although it had a very modest budget of some $6 million a year, that budget was a totally discretionary one, and how it was spent or in what area was in fact determined by the then Space Council, but largely by the Space Office. And for example, if money was available, organisations such as ASRI could have been supported. Now, to achieve that now is a very, very difficult task because money is largely locked up into fixed programs. Programs that the functions and the administration have been determined through an act of parliament with absolutely no flexibility to really change. That's only if someone happens to have a bit of well, I guess, loose change in various buckets that they can release, that organisations such as this can get some assistance. But more importantly, even things like our involvement with AATSR, that was only possible because of the discretionary nature of the budget, where the council decided, yes, we will go with AATSR rather than, say, some other program. Now, that type of flexibility is no longer available, except to the extent that in the CRC for satellite systems, where Brian can adjust the goals of the program, but it's still FedSat. I doubt very much that he could pursue a space infrastructure program, even if that's where all priorities pointed to. Well, just moving on, onto the objectives, I just briefly go through those. They're pretty standard policy sort of statements, and they appeared in various press releases some 12 months or so ago. And as you can see, they involve representing Australia's space policy nationally and internationally, and largely facilitating industry, but in a commercial sense rather than a developmental sense. If you can move to the next slide, please. And just moving from those objectives, we're able to just put together a few of our roles and functions. These are clearly broader. It's intended to be broad. That way, no matter what you do, you can always find a slot to justify what you're doing. But one of our functions is to provide policy advice to the minister, and I'll get onto some of the aspects where that is in fact happening. Act as the initial point of contact within the department. Now, that is a major point. If you do need to deal with government, we should be your first point of contact. Having then discussed the matter with perhaps more appropriate areas, we can then redirect you or work with you to move to other more specific areas. We coordinate space projects within the department to the point that is possible. Clearly, issues such as funding through Oz Industry, although there is the opportunity to deal directly with that organisation, we can still participate and be a devil's advocate on the part or on behalf of various peoples. And that follows on to the industry measures. And from your perspective, probably the and certainly your future ambitions, we do have a function to register space objects, and that flows from a United Nations treaty where every nation has to register satellites with the United Nations, and that involves quite a few organisations, and because of the liability implications, it's quite a messy and tedious task. And because of our current lack of legislation, it's almost impossible to do at the moment, and I'll get onto that in a moment. Next slide, please. This slide just addresses four launch projects that the department, in particular the Space Policy Unit, is involved with in varying degrees. I imagine that you're all quite familiar with all of these. The Proton launch program, which is currently planned for the either Gunpoint or Melville Island area, run by STS. That's a project that has major projects facilitation status, and by and large, we do get some involvement with that organisation, but that's largely looked after by another area of the department, as is the IRC, which will be looking at the using the Soyuz. Of course, the problem with Soyuz is it's not particularly capable for geostationary launches, although it can put modest payloads into that orbit. And its commercial success, we hope that they can do something out of that. The two lower projects have got a different level of interest. For example, the ULS, which is an offshoot of the STS, much the same people are involved, and they're developing a launch vehicle called Unity with the Russian Cosmos Group, and they propose to operate from the Gladstone area. So I can't remember the name of an island, but it's an island just offshore from Gladstone, and they aim to launch LEO payloads from there. And the Kistler vehicle, where we're directly involved with that, one of the guys that works for me, Mike Hettinger, works almost full time with Kistler in trying to get this. It's a reusable two-stage launch vehicle, which will be operating from Woomera. In fact, I'm going to Adelaide from here tonight, and be going up to Woomera to meet with the chief executive and others from Kistler, who have just come into Australia this weekend. Although our involvement with these projects isn't that great, we're not. They're all commercial projects. Because of the potential of these projects, that it has created a number of difficulties for government, and it's highlighted a lack of activity that the government has simply ignored over the years, and which now does need to be addressed if these projects are to take place in Australia at all. Probably the most significant aspect, from not only from the launch vehicle point of view, but also from operating satellites, Australian-owned satellites, is that Australia's party to five United Nations treaties. The three more significant ones are the Outer Space Treaty, the Liability Convention, and the Registration Convention. The liability one being the foremost one. Essentially, having signed up to those treaties, the Commonwealth has total and absolute liability for any damage caused to third international parties as a result of its launch activities, and by the same token, and any damage that could be caused by an Australian payload if it's launched by an overseas launch organisation. And that liability is not shared. If you put up a FedSat, which might be a 100 kilo type of satellite, in with a couple of geo type mass payloads, the liability isn't distributed on the basis of mass or cost. It is it is shared. So you can find that, for example, there's a small company in Queanbeyan, just out of Canberra, who've developed and have had manufactured a laser test bed satellite, which weighs about 50 kilos. It's about the size of a soccer ball, and that's going to be launched by the Russian Space Agency. It should have been launched by about now, but if something goes astray with that, and the major payloads on that launch will be Russian military payloads. If something goes astray there, well, Australia has an equal and joint responsibility for whatever damage occurs. So you've got this soccer ball type satellite which really creates a liability factor of something like $200 million. And just the insurance bill on that is greater than the cost of developing the satellite. So there are issues like that that we have to address. And it's as a result of these United Nations treaties that the need for legislation to govern launching and operating satellites, the sharing of liabilities, and simply enabling the industry to be able to establish itself, and that's really created our need for this legislation. We have moved towards that. However, we haven't got approval to prepare legislation as such because of the very large amounts of money involved in, because of the liability aspect. The Cabinet will have to give approval not only for the preparation of legislation, but in so doing, acknowledge that they have this liability and acknowledge that they're prepared to see such industry grow in Australia. Could I have the next slide, please? So some 2 years ago, in fact, when the Russian project was first mooted for Australia, that even in Space Office days, the legislation aspect was recognised, or the lack of legislation, and some steps were taken towards looking at what would be needed and what sort of format it should take and what should be covered. And of course, in the usual way, we looked at what's done in the United States, in the UK and other countries, and we did prepare a draft based very much on the United States model. And of course, we acted in our own right, and one of the problems with engineers, you do things and then you suddenly find that there's a vast amount of bureaucracy that doesn't agree with the approach you've taken or the language you've used, etc. So we did finally get that right, even though theoretically we should not have got this far without approval. And the Office of Parliamentary Council, which is the legislative drafting body for government, has in fact drafted legislation for us, at least the first draft, and that was completed around about April, May this year. And the type of issues that are covered in that, and I can't go into any more detail than that because I legally can't, other than to say that in the new, and in fact I can't even make copy. I'm not even allowed to make copies for the people who have to consider it. Somehow I have to go back to the Office of the Parliamentary Council and get them to reissue other numbered copies of this legislation, because until it reaches a stage where it can formally go out for consultation with potential stakeholders, it's got to be kept totally undercover, particularly seeing as the government hasn't even approved the drafting yet. The areas that we clearly need to address are licensing issues for the launch vehicles, insurance to offset liabilities, approval of the actual launch sites, and this takes into account both state and Commonwealth requirements for safety and the various other issues. The aspects associated with registration of satellites because of the liability that flows from that, and then more from the actual launch activity, the range safety requirements, the need for range safety officers, their powers, etc. We need to put in legislation so they can't be challenged. One aspect, of course, that we unfortunately have to pursue is fees, launch fees. Simple fact of life that the current arrangements within government are user pays, and to administer this legislation you will need some sort of a regulatory and safety office, and its costs have to be passed on to some extent, and that has yet to be negotiated with the Department of Finance, but there's no way other than there will be some sort of a launch fee. Now, it's very, very difficult to determine what would be fair. Clearly you can't set it at a level that would be a total disincentive for industry. But by the same token, you have to meet the government's budgetary requirements that the Department of Finance impose on us, and we'll have to strike some sort of a balance. They could be quite modest in terms of the overall cost of a launch, particularly in terms of, say, the insurance needs, but $50,000-$100,000 for a licence fee could be quite a disincentive in its own right. And then finally, of course, the legislation will address liability and compensation should there be an accident. And the final stage is the legislation will be fairly broad in its own right, and it'll empower the minister, in other words, the department or the licensing organisation, to make detailed regulations in the same way as the Civil Aviation Safety Authority can do. Now, just that legislation, as I said, the first formal draft, in fact, has been prepared, but it can't even be processed until Cabinet gives approval for its preparation. Probably the only good news is that for about a year we've been trying to get to that point, and I was notified yesterday that Cabinet will be considering the submission in relation to legislation this coming Tuesday. So on Wednesday we'll either have the basis to look to the future or to look for new jobs. Well, that's certainly how my situation will be.
Next slide, please.
I did mention that once we get this decision, clearly we'll be pursuing the preparation and finalisation of the legislation. But in parallel with that, we will need to establish some sort of a licensing authority. In so doing, we had to ask a number of questions. Some of them were instantly answered for us. For example, there's just no way that the government would wear an independent agency. Nevertheless, you have to ask these questions. Of course, what should be done within the bureaucracy? What is best outsourced to organisations that have got the expertise and maintain the expertise? Just for example, one of the functions will be a certification of launch vehicles. Now, you can get someone into the bureaucracy who has got the expertise to do that, but if you're only going to do it three times in your lifetime, that expertise is quite biodegradable, and so it wouldn't be wise to try and establish that expertise full time in there. And the other thing, of course, is that that all has to be offset through fees. So we have to make some judgments as to what should be done in house and what shouldn't. Particularly, the aim will be that the activities have to be conducted, but the cost has to be kept to an absolute minimum, because they will have to be passed on to launch operators. With regards to this Space Licensing and Safety Office, I think you can just about take that down. If there is going to be such an organisation, it will be called a SLASO. It's better than SPEW anyway. And there'll be two elements. Of course, the Space Policy Unit will still remain within the department to conduct its policy functions, for example, such as arranging treaty level agreements, say, between Australia and Russia for the operation of those launch vehicles in Australia, etc. This organisation will be more directly involved with the actual functioning of launch activities in Australia. And it'll be broken into two areas. I wouldn't want to be too prescriptive, although I have a few thoughts that I've put down, because eventually whoever runs that organisation probably would like some flexibility to establish it in the way they have to live with it. But clearly there'll have to be an area that addresses licensing and registration of launch vehicles, payloads, etc. And another side, which involves a different level of expertise, which addresses mission safety and verification. And perhaps that's the area where a certain amount of the activity could be outsourced. For example, the accident investigation function, we'd be really looking at the aviation safety people to conduct that on our behalf. And what we would do would be just be a budgetary amount set aside for that type of work. And if the unfortunate situation arose, then BASI would be called in to conduct the actual investigation into the incident. So I'll just move into those two specific areas, and I'll just expand on those a bit. With the licensing and registration aspect, that fits in reasonably well within the Bureau. You can transfer a particular mission. Weapons of mass destruction and non-proliferation, etc. Payload would be launched from Australia if it contained nuclear fuels for their power plant system. That may change in the future, but that's the type of thing that we'd have great difficulty with. And of course, if someone sneaks in some sort of other little nasty, be it of the explosive nature or of the spying nature, that the Commonwealth would want to know, and probably would not authorise its launch. I've got these support arrangements for liability agreements with foreign governments. What the situation is there is that, and this extends also to some of the other areas, that clearly this licensing organisation will have to keep across what is happening internationally, and will have to establish appropriate agreements with their counterparts, particularly if you're talking about launching United States payloads from Australia. There will have to be quite a bit of negotiation between this body and its counterpart in the United States Department of Transportation. And probably the final area that would be of interest to you, particularly in your ambitions with the ASRI launch vehicle development, is the certification and licensing of these launch vehicles. And I'll address that in a little bit more detail in a moment. Just move on to the next slide and just look at some of the issues from the other side of this proposed organisation. I must say these are we've done quite a lot of work on this, but it is totally unofficial. It has no sanction by the bureaucracy or my masters, but hopefully as a result of, well, if we get a favourable decision on Tuesday, that a number of these issues will be able to be pursued formally, and they will come into being. The type of work we envisage that would be done under the safety and verification would be to conduct hazard analyses for missions. One of the things that would flow from that, of course, would be insurance needs, as well as whether, in fact, you can authorise that type of flight. One of the main areas would be overflying largely populated areas would be one of the things where hazard analysis would come into play in a big way. The sort of acceptable risk statistics that we would adopt are very similar to what applies in the aviation industry, and it's the magical 1/10⁻⁶. If it's less than that, the chances of there being a mishap are very, very remote. And of course the insurance aspects associated with that are also equally low. If you start finding that a particular launch trajectory has a much higher potential for
injury or death of people on the ground, then you'd either not authorise it or require such massive insurance requirements that it's the equivalent of not authorising it. The termination or suspension of launch operations, this applies to, well, someone from the government's going to have to be able to press the destruct mechanism, if there is such a thing, on the particular launch vehicle. The Kistler proposal, of course, does not have a destruct mechanism, but it has a flight termination system. And that would be a decision for the range safety officer to make. And he'd have to have the power to be able to do that without being challenged. If the safety parameters are exceeded in any way, either by trajectory or whatever, particularly in the first stage of the launch, he must have that power. And then, of course, without going into great detail there's the issue of confirming that no TAMS and other type notices are out if there's a launch, that aviation, shipping, etc. are aware of it. And the final area that they will have to address will be incident investigation, both as a result of something going wrong in flight, or even perhaps a major problem in ground handling of the launch vehicle and its systems. Now, I've just touched on some of the areas that we believe will need to be addressed. Now, this will only be the starting point for whoever is tasked with setting up this organisation. At least there's some guidelines. And as I said, I don't think it would be it's reasonable to embark on an organisation that has never existed in this country before, and there aren't very many in the world anyway, and to be prescriptive to the point where you get a bureaucrat telling the people who actually know what they're doing how to do it. Next slide, please. I mentioned the launch licence issue, and we won't belabour the cost aspects of it, but clearly there'll have to be some sort of formal process, and every country has different arrangements in this area, and our view is that there are some aspects of a launch licence that really don't have to be repeated for every launch, and I guess you call those the non-recurring areas, and that can be issued quite early in the piece, and that would remain for as long as the that launch vehicle doesn't change its configuration significantly, or there are any other major changes to the way it's going to operate, and. So we've called that part one, just to be very innovative as compared to part two, which is the second part, which would cover the more mission specific issues. Clearly, types of payloads, the trajectories, particularly in overflight, etc. That will require another licensing approach. And you may be able to agree that you can have a long term part two if the launch provider is just going to launch in the same sector and the same group or the class of payloads. Well, you might be able to give a long term approval there, and that would constitute the full launch license. But just briefly. On the part one, clearly there's going to have to be some sort of type approval or certification of the launch vehicle, not to the same rigour that civil aircraft need, because obviously we're not having paying passengers on board, but nevertheless there are still some both engineering and mission safety aspects associated with that. I would also expect that to the extent that it's possible, for example, if a United States launch vehicle would be used here, or a Russian vehicle, as is also proposed, that if there's a satisfactory certification and type approval existing within the country of origin, that apart from collecting the appropriate data pack that represents that type approval, it would be little more than a paper exercise on behalf of Australia. But that's not necessarily the case. I know, for example, that in the case of the Kistler project, because they intend to start their test launches from Australia with an unproven vehicle, that in fact type approval will have to be given in Australia. So the certification process will need to be conducted here. To some extent, we recognise that there'll also be need to have some sort of a site approval. I think this is a bit of a secondary issue, but certainly facilities for handling hazardous materials, fuels, etc., that will have to be certified from a public safety point of view, an environmental point of view. And once that's been cleared, I guess that there may be an occasional follow-up to see that systems haven't deteriorated, that they are being maintained, etc. There'd have to be an ongoing thing there. But that's the sort of thing that is really also a one-off. And, of course, associated with that, we would like to see some sort of an operations approval where, as I indicated earlier, as long as launch is going to be in a certain sector and a certain class of payload, etc., that you can give advanced approval for those types of missions. And that would constitute the part one. The part two, of course, you have to have part one before you can get part two. That's rule number one in any bureaucracy. And really the second aspect is associated with the payload. You may not know in detail what sort of payload is involved. So, and it may require, well, they may want a trajectory that's somewhat different to the standard. That would need to be addressed prior to giving that final approval to launch. And of course, finally, there'd have to be a bit of a last minute aspect to address such things as weather, or defence may suddenly decide that they're going to have a massive exercise in the area on the day of the launch, and you may have to cancel launch. So there will be circumstances where the final launch licence could be held up right up to just hours beforehand. Perhaps it's not so much a license as a final approval, but nevertheless it constitutes the part of the licensing concept. And of course, apart from the licensing, we've addressed in some detail the needs associated with granting type approval, etc., but I haven't prepared anything along those lines at this stage. But we have developed quite a bit of work to address most of these issues. I can now just move on to the final area, which is probably more germane to why we exist, and that's the so-called space policy. I think you'll all probably be aware that there really is no such thing as a national space policy at present. In fact, I'm not certain that there ever was. I've been with the space office since late '89, and despite the fact that there was an Australian Space Board and an Australian Space Council and vast numbers of very glossy documents called a strategy for space industry or something like that, and then the subsequent 5-year plan machinations of the council, I don't think there was a policy that was endorsed by government for space for Australia. In fact, I'm quite confident that there isn't one now, and there never has been one. And I think that this issue has to be addressed. It is the only way that you can get government to commit to at least some very fundamental parameters that will govern how this industry will or will not develop in this country. There probably is one hint of space policy. I think about the only thing we've seen was as a result of the closure of the Space Office on the 20th of August, there was a ministerial press release that briefly stated what COSA would do and what the Space Policy Unit would do. I think that's not a satisfactory situation, and I've already had some very brief discussions with Brian this morning, which indicates that we will have to take this up seriously so that we do work in an integrated way in the future. The one issue, though, is that also for the first time in close to 20 years, we might actually have an industry policy for Australia, which has also been absent. Now, there's just no way that you could really have a space policy or space industry policy in isolation of a broad national industry policy. Now, many of you may have heard of a document called the Mortimer Report, which made a number of recommendations to government in relation to industry policy. There has been a task force in the Department of Industry, Science and Tourism which has been addressing the Mortimer Report and a response to it. I haven't seen that, but I know that quite a large group have been working on that. Those recommendations will be considered by Cabinet this Monday, and the Prime Minister is expected to make an announcement on Monday night in relation to that, to industry policy. And that will be the baseline for how we address space industry within the context of that broader policy. And clearly we can't isolate the two. But without one, there was no way we could even embark on a second one. I've indicated there that we will have to develop some sort of a policy, a space policy in the coming year. And there are few features that I see in it. Last week I attended a bit of a seminar on space policy implications for industry, and a number of industry representatives gave their views. And the type of thing that they would like to see addressed in these policies is that not only should you have the broad objectives, but you should aim to point out, what your targets and benchmarks with some sort of a time frame. That's a commitment that government would give to achieving. The role of government should be spelt out. Now there's a lot of aspects here. Is first of all, should government be involved at all in that industry? Should be any intervention, and by intervention I mean such things, because of market failures, whether there should be an industry assistance program, and does it apply to some industries and not to others? The regulatory aspect, you can unwittingly regulate an industry out of existence. And of course, the Commonwealth and state relationship in relation to industry, and in particular to space industry. Clearly, at the moment, as far as the launch proposals are concerned, there's been quite an extensive dialogue between the federal government and certainly our department and my area, and both the Queensland and South Australian governments, and to some extent also with the Northern Territory government as a result of the Gunpoint Melville Island proposal. So a number of those issues have to be addressed because, for example, in Queensland, they've established some sort of a science council. Now, you know, they could well be duplicating many of the things that, in fact, possibly should be in the federal sphere, and perhaps some areas are more appropriate for the state to handle. It's not just a case of what is the most logical approach. There's also a legal basis for who can do what in this country. So those issues have to be sorted out with the states. The distribution of responsibilities, I think that's one area that we should address. I showed you that slide earlier of the industry, science and tourism portfolio and all the disparate groups within the one portfolio who have an input into a space, and I think that has to be resolved. You know, exactly where these organisations fit in, how they work together, and who has what, you know, particular responsibilities. Just by way of example, over the past 12 months, in an absence of space policy as such, Brian Embleton's people, and who had for some years been involved in international organisations such as ESCAP, etc. Now, that is very much a policy type of function, and we weren't. The reason that was because it suited us not to be, and it suited Brian's people to continue to be. Now, that's not necessarily the best way to do things. And that's the type of issue that we do have to take on. And finally, sectoral considerations. Now, by sectoral, I mean the space sector specifically. Now, there will be, within the industry policy statement on Monday, I expect that there will be specific mention of how sectors will be treated. Now, you've all heard of statements along the lines that, you know, the government shouldn't pick winners, etc., etc. Well, you know, another motherhood statement's like, you know, winners pick themselves, etc. But I think that's really not good enough. And in particular, in emerging industries, there is real reason for greater government intervention than perhaps in the more established industries. And yet we still find quite significant intervention by government in what really are can be considered very mature industries, such as, you know, textile, clothing and footwear, or the motor industry. And there is, you know, they are treated as sectoral policies, one might say that the government's clearly not picking winners. They're really picking losers. Whichever way you go, you can run into strife. But the space sector, as such, I believe will need a certain amount of special attention. I also think that this is an area where quite a large amount of consultation should take place, not only between the bureaucratic and government areas, but also by proponents of major projects who should have an input into that side of the policy. And to the extent that it's possible, industry representative groups, such as the Australian Space Industry Chamber of Commerce, and we would need to have more consultation with those. Of course, but in this policy framework, the only people who have credibility to the bureaucracy are the bureaucracy itself. The project proponents, such as, you know, IRC, STS, etc., they will have to show that, you know, what their credibility is to some extent to really to have any influence in this area. Same applies to the Space Industry Chamber of Commerce, and to some extent, I would say ASRI. The the government will want to see input from bodies that really have really got some muscle. Otherwise, it simply won't take it seriously. So I guess that in our consultations with the various groups on a policy issue next year, I think that we'll have to look at ourselves and say, how serious are we, what chance have we got of swaying the situation? I mean, clearly the clothing and footwear people are. There's only some 90,000 people employed in that industry throughout Australia, and yet they have massive clout. I would hope that an organisation that represents space, or maybe space and aerospace, or there may be some other way, would be able to get together and be able to represent this area of technology to government and do the appropriate bargaining that's necessary. And as I said there, last statement is that however we approach this task, it will have to be done in consultation with, I said, relevant stakeholders. I think in the past the tendency has been to say with all stakeholders, but I know that would be ridiculous because you'd have 5,000 people claiming to be stakeholders, so and that's where the credibility issue would come in. If you've got credibility, I think you could be considered part of the stakeholders. And I think it should be a feature of the policy that policy will be issued in consultation with stakeholders, not just a throwaway line that I've put here for your benefit. And that's all I've got to say. I'll be quite happy to answer any questions if there are any. Okay. At the moment, when you say overseas, can you be more specific? The US has no launch, has no licensing fees at all. As the reason being, firstly, all launching is done from ex-military facilities, or certainly all government-owned facilities. There are fees associated with use of some of the facilities. That's a separate issue. The other thing is that the license, or the applicant, has to bear the total cost of submitting for a license, but they don't have any license fees at present. However, I do know that they are looking at this issue in the way that we have too, to charge fees, but I'm certainly. I haven't heard that $5 million bit before. If you spread that around, it'll make the $100,000 look pretty cheap. I guess if you're looking at the total cost of certifying a new vehicle. Doing all the risk and hazard analyses, all the environmental impact statement work, et cetera, it could come up to that sort of a cost, but that's not a license fee. I'm talking about, a fee per launch or per group of launchings, which would be a separate thing.
I must say it's very refreshing to hear someone from the government saying they want to minimise the cost to industry and don't want to regulate it out of existence.
Well, actually, from large parts of our department feel that way, and would like to see it that way. There are two other organisations. One's called the Treasury, and the other one, Department of Finance. And they only seem like bad guys because, in fact, they are bad guys. But to be quite honest, the government outlines what a budget strategy will be. Now, for example, in the forthcoming financial year, the requirements on the Department of Finance are to achieve a balanced budget, as compared to, in this financial year, they had to make savings of $4 billion. Now, Department of Finance, it's very easy to approve additional expenditure. So, you know, their start point is to say no, no matter what it is, and to recover as much as possible so that they, because they're given the charter to achieve a balanced budget, because they control the expenditure. So there will be problems with there. For, you know, when I mentioned this, the licence fee aspect. Now, in the start-up phase of these launch projects, there probably wouldn't be a need for a very large organisation regulating the industry. If you could keep it down to, say, five people, it's a pretty small organisation, but I think it's possible. Now, if you just had to recover the cost of those five people at, say, $100,000 a year, that's $500,000, plus, then that would just about cover also accommodation and other costs. Now, you have to recover that. If you have to recover that $500,000 fully, you can do it in one of two ways. You know, if there's only one operator, whether they have one launch or 50 launches, you don't care what the price is going to be per launch, as long as you pick up $500,000 at the end of the year. If there are two operators, you share those costs. If you have a 30-person organisation, then you start having a different problem yet again. The other approach is, well, why not waive all fees for the first year and then just add a little bit extra on in subsequent years to make up for so at least give people a chance to start. There are all these options, and I'm quite certain that my department and industry can come up with some very amicable and sensible approaches to this. Now, whether that will be accepted by Department of Finance is another issue.
Would you be planning on having your department do the independent safety assessment or get the operator, the user, to do that, submit it to you just for assessment? Or
yes. Yes.
So the provider of the launch vehicle will give you the safety assessment?
Yes.
And you will validate it?
Yes. I would say that for those things, I would prefer to see it that type of thing contracted out. You'll clearly need to have someone that's independent and with appropriate expertise. Unfortunately, the level of expertise around this country isn't that vast in these areas, and the potential conflict of interest is very great because. I mean, if you just look at FedSat, just about everybody's involved in FedSat, and if FedSat submits a risk analysis for their mission, and there's not going to be anybody else other than within FedSat then to validate it for us. You know, I don't know how we're going to get around that, but that would be the approach. It's not something that's going to happen. You know, on a regular basis, and once again, that's a very perishable level of skill, and you just can't afford to have a make-believe expert in the bureaucracy that within 2 or 3 years you could totally lose. So that would be the only safe way. And then you could afford to do the job properly that way because you're not carrying dead wood for the other 11 months of the year. Maybe I should clarify this for you. Regardless of what sort of speech the Prime Minister makes, there will be no space budget. Not as such. There is likely to be the statement is likely to include the type of industry measures or industry assistance measures that will be available within the department. More than likely through Oz Industry or the CRC program. There's definitely not been put any proposal to government that there should be a separate space budget at the moment other than what Brian has achieved through the CRC process. I mean, that was one of the reasons why they closed down the space office, was in fact to save that very minuscule space budget. And time is just not ripe to go back to government, you know, within a year and say, we want $20 million a year. It just won't wash. However, I think that the way some of these projects, major projects, are now progressing, and we'd only need, you know, in the first instance, one of the launch vehicle projects to really get going. And people like the Ares people and FedSat saying we are actually, you know, cutting metal and soldering in integrated circuits, that, you know, you'll start to change the attitude. But at the moment, whenever you talk about space, the only recognition that you get from a large part of the public, and certainly within government, oh, that's that Cape York stuff, you know, and that's totally, you know, created a false impression of what the space industry is about, because they just think in terms of, you know, of the fact that the Cape York projects of 10 years ago didn't go ahead, and why have we wasted all that money there for?
Good.